course. A Simcar 9, we're going to dive into valuations of used cars. So you're shopping, and you said you wanted to share a bit of experience with that. So you're shopping for a Mercedes, I believe, and what have you found?
Well, I'm kind of, it was a holiday. It was one of those things when you're sitting around and you haven't as much to do, and you're thinking of fun things to do.
Let's go shopping.
People like to shop, right? But I think the idea of I had it in my mind to update, not upgrade necessarily, but update my one of my cars, and nothing wrong with it except that it's a long story. There's some rust that has formed on some body panels due to a major screw up by the manufacturer, in this case Mercedes, in the switchover. So it's a long story, but as far as I can put it together, what happened is that they went to in around 2000, they went late 90s, maybe even, they went to a water based paint process, and the water based paints are much thinner than the previous process, the I guess petroleum based, and or whatever synthetic it is, and as a result, the types of metal they were using on the cars was the paint process was picking up imperfections, and the metal was galvanized. And they began doing galvanization in their cars back in the 90s or even earlier, 80s probably. But when they went to the new paint process, it appears that the galvanized steel was not smooth enough for the new paint. And in fact, they had regulations in place. They had to switch over. So they decided to compromise on the galvanization. And as a result, the cars are rust prone. And then this became a scandal in terms of the quality of these cars in that era. For a few years, the cars, although not universally, I think it depends on conditions, the cars ended up having a lot of rust. And that's just unacceptable for that brand.
So we're talking about 14 or 15 years later, right? Interesting.
Yeah. It only showed up, you know, about 10 years later, yeah. I would say. So they were out of warranty. So a lot of the owners were screwed. And what happened also is as a result, the resale value or the used value of those cars plummeted.
Right. The darker.
And I don't know if only Mercedes was affected, but they certainly took a lot of heat. But I'm not giving up on the brand on that basis. So I'm considering actually getting a newer version of the same car. And by the way, the rust can be repaired, but people have advised me it's not worth it. So it's a beater now, you know, essentially. It's a good car, but there's just cosmetically, it's not pretty. It's not structural yet.
Diesel or petrol cars?
Well, this is in the U.S., so it's a U.S. And although there are diesels in the U.S., that particular model is a gas model. Okay. And it's a station wagon, so it's nothing fancy, but it's, and I really like it. I mean, it's a great road trip car. We used it to drive to New York for a couple of trips down there for both personal but also business. We did the air shows there, so we piled as many as five guys and all our gear in that one car, and we had a 4 or 5 hour trip, and it was perfectly comfortable for five grown men to sit in it for that time. But anyway, I don't want to talk too much about that. The point is, I want to talk about the experience I had when I went back and looked at used cars. So I thought to myself, well, what is the latest, or not the latest, what is it an acceptable replacement for this car? And I thought of looking at once the process had been fixed, and anyone who knows more, please enlighten us. I just read a few forums online and seemed to indicate that was the issue with the galvanization and the paint. But according to some people, they went back to galvanization in 2003, and so somehow they worked out how to get the smooth finish, and all of that worked out by 2003. It's still not as good now as it used to be in the pre-water-based paint era. You still have a small ripple effect. in the final finish, but at least they're not rusting anymore. And that started in 2003. So I was thinking to get a 2004 model, which also had a facelift. And anyway, so I'm looking around, and I hadn't done this in a long time, especially in the U.S., especially on eBay. So that car which I have now, which is a 2001, was purchased on eBay in 2005. And now I'm looking to replace it. So it's 9, 10 years later in terms of my experience in buying a used car. But it hasn't changed much in terms of the eBay and motors.ebay.com. And I wouldn't consider using a dealer. I would consider using a local purchasing experience. I want to do it not in any rush. So I would go through and slowly figure it out. What's the process again? But it's striking to me though, when I went through this process and making bids and sort of checking things out, that, how did I feel as a buyer, even with the patience of not being impulsive about it, that it was still a very, there are a couple of issues. One is that you still feel somewhat at the mercy of the seller, because they know a lot about the car and you don't. You also notice, though, that prices are very low on used cars, and there are many, many cars. Even the most recent models, if they're 1 year old, obviously the asking price or the whatever gets transacted on eBay, because right. You can look at ended auctions. You can see that there's a huge drop in value, and that even applies to cars like Tesla. There are Teslas on eBay, and they're not the same price as a new Tesla. And so the Model S, yes, you can buy one on eBay. And the thing is though, that this huge delta in the initial price. Now, some older cars, like 10 years old, those are what I'm looking at, are almost, 80% off. Like you're paying 20 to even less than that. Depends on the models. Depends on the brands.
Right. Honda is very different than a German car, for example, and a 10-year-old car.
Well, in what way, though? I haven't checked.
The valuation, you should look at Civic prices, for example. The percentage loss, it's quite interesting. I mean, and I only know this because I have friends who commute, and they tend to try to buy 5 to 7 year old Civics, and Honda has a good reputation, at least still.
Well, it could be, and certainly that used to be the case for Mercedes. They had the best resale value, right. and in fact nowadays, even I just glanced at some other prices, but if you compare a mid '90s Mercedes, it's almost the same price as a mid 2000s Mercedes.
Those were the best Mercedes ever built. Yes.
Yes. Well, I had one, so I still do actually, yeah. Those cars, they went down for a long time, but they plateaued. So now they're kind of, become the same price if they're maintained. They don't depreciate anymore.
Right.
In fact, I even spotted 80s Mercedes that had been essentially not rebuilt, or what's the word, when you renovate a car to showroom condition.
Yeah, parts are remanufactured. They're restored, I guess.
Yeah. Oh, restored. Yeah, that's the word I was thinking of. Yeah. It wasn't a restored car because it was a station wagon. It's like a pretty boring car, but it was a diesel. But it was like reconditioned to the point where everything ran and it looked good. And that car was worth as much, a 1980s model, as much as a car only in 2005.
Well, those Mercedes diesels from that era have a certain cachet in a small segment of the market in the States. They can fuel up at McDonald's or some of they use these different oils.
Biodiesel, right.
Biodiesel.
Well,
right.
It's true in that they're kind of gentrified cars in a way.
Exactly.
So people who are kind of hipsters are now buying those older cars. Like they used to buy the VW buses, but those are hardly any left over. So now you're going to go get a diesel Mercedes wagon. But so that these are matters of
you taste know, and fashion, style, yes.
fashion, style, whatever. But the thing is, there's a lot of variability. You can't make a generalized statement. So, I own a Mini in Europe, or more than one. But the Minis are actually holding their value, like you said, also for the Civics, very well in the U.S. So there's actually not a bargain to getting one, but there are bargains on these larger cars. Mercedes now, and that's a surprise in some ways. But the overall question is why do prices drop so dramatically on some cars, or in general on used cars? I tweeted the question and sort of a half knowing the answer, but to get feedback on what do people think. And, as usual, you can get answers across the board in all kinds of questions. So my question was, why do used cars depreciate so quickly? And the answers were all over the place. People said, it's about prestige of ownership of a new car. It is also about the fact that they don't work as well and so on. But it doesn't explain, first, the precipitous drop right out of the gate. So a used car, even a year old, is much cheaper than a brand new one. I think that might be explained. It's not pretty explained by mechanical issues. It's going to be explained more by the prestige issues. But it's also because there is this notion that the car is pristine, and then it's no longer pristine. So you don't know what other things might be wrong with it. And if the logic I had was here's my epiphany on this, because looking at two identical used cars, if one has a very rich record history of its maintenance, and there's a service Carfax that provides an event history, whether those events might be, registration, inspections, accidents, if they were maintained. Yeah. If the problem is that the data is incomplete, so you can't say that it covers all the events. But the point is that if one has a Carfax history and if one has a service history, then automatically as a potential buyer, I was like, oh, I'm easily going to pay $1,000 more for that, or $2,000 more, over an identical vehicle that has no history. So the question I had was in my mind: what if that vehicle actually had a perfect history? What is a perfect history? Not only all the events that occurred, but literally that you could audit its existence completely, like where it went, how fast it went, did it break suddenly, and that data is available. Obviously, in these black boxes, right? We're seeing more and more of that, but normally that's not packaged in a way that a potential buyer might be able to look at it. And you're going to need a tool to wade through it. And ideally, you want to actually have someone analyze it for you and give you a scorecard.
Right.
And then, like Carfax does, they try to simplify, even if only there's a dozen records which you can read through with your own eyes simply and understand exactly what happened, they still kind of create this star system and this checkbox system to simplify it for you. But the idea is if you had millions of records, which you would if that car was self-monitoring, then you would need an analytical tool to go through that data. And as we talked earlier, if I have an app on my phone that can record my journey and give me precise information on how to improve my gas mileage, how to improve my driving style, that is currently available for exactly €2. But if you could get that embedded in the car and then have it track and continuously it will just not destroy the data, it would keep a complete accumulation of all its activity. That, as a buyer, I would say is worth thousands and thousands, which means as a seller, it's worth thousands and thousands. So I would rather have that information than, let's say, an in-car navigation system or a vanity, audio system or something like that. I think that's an interesting opportunity, and that got me to think, that about the asymmetry of information, and there's actually a lot of work on this idea, it turns out. And I kind of had heard about it, but I had forgotten about it. So someone reminded me on Twitter about it, this paper, a Nobel Prize winning paper on, it's called The Market for Lemons. I'm just pulling it up here on my screen. And there was a 1970 paper written by the economist George Akerlof, and it discusses information asymmetry, and it was called the Market for Lemons, Quality Uncertainty and the Market Mechanism. And the explanation, I take it, and by the way, the Nobel Prize was given in 2001, quite a long time, 30 years after it was written. But this idea of asymmetry of information between seller and buyer is very deeply embodied in the used car business, much more so than almost any other product, because there is this wear and tear on the product. There are many ways that it can be this, you know, cosmetically hidden what is wrong with it. And so because the buyer is so vulnerable, they're going to pay a lot less. And so it actually doesn't benefit the seller or the dealer network, let's say, to hide constantly this information. It would benefit actually if they could expose more information, because then the value would go up. People would increase the trust level in the old cars,
but that would also change the value when you're trading in your 2001 Mercedes, right?
Yes, of course.
There's sort of the inverse risk for that. The current model.
We don't know what would happen if the information were available about the car. If it was self-monitoring, mm-hmm. In the vehicle market would change dramatically in ways that we cannot predict. I think it might cause values to go up. It might actually also cause transactions to go down, because the seller of the car would gain more confidence that their car isn't broken, or that you know, imagine if you could just post, you know, a zip file and you know, you're selling your car and say, hey, go to a forum and post your zip file. I said, do you think this car is a loss? You know, I should get rid of it, or should I keep it? Is it worth fixing? And you know, with an algorithm or some inspection, you'd say, you know, these problems that you're talking about are in your mind. This car is perfect. So then you see what I mean.
Except Horace. So the data already exists. You know, GM's OnStar program. Now I'm talking about the States. Has had GPS for quite a few years, and they, if you look at their license agreements, they sell that data to insurance companies, and that's how you get some of this crowdsourced traffic data around the U.S.
Yeah.
Is they're aggregating it. So it's existed for more than a decade.
Well,
but
some,
it hasn't been leveraged yet for this purpose, maybe because
exactly.
of other interests.
Yeah. It's not an open market for the data in the
right.
sense that the whole point of the paper is information asymmetry. It's like, who has that information? And the point about it hasn't crossed the chasm from being something that's embedded and sort of for mechanics to know. I mean, there's a huge amount of information you can obtain if a mechanic were to inspect the car and honestly give you a thorough review of it. It may not cost all that much for this type of inspection, and you would know a lot. And sometimes that's what's used by the buyer to gain that information from the car. And that they have to pay for it. But I'm saying that the granularity, it's not only, there is onboard monitoring going on, but I'm saying to have it packaged in a way that can be consumed, have the parameters being monitored, not only include things that are of interest to insurance people or mechanics, but also things about the owner's behavior and so on. Meaning, you know, the driving style, maybe that is of importance to insurance, but I'm just saying that there are heuristics you can use. I mean, in the sense of, think about what Google's doing with the driverless cars. They have to obtain gigabytes of data a day, probably, and most of it is not retained, but about the environment, about everything that's happening. Now you get into all kinds of privacy issues, and I completely concede that. But what I'm saying is that we're at the point right now where there's no information, essentially, except for Carfax. And then there's this other extreme where you actually capture with sensors everything.
Mm-hmm.
Which might violate a lot of people's sense of privacy. But somewhere in between these two extremes, there is a possibility of using intelligent or information and intelligence about the car to affect its value. So we've been talking over these last few, you know, over these episodes about the impact of technology on the auto industry. So one way was, what if personal technology were modular enough or acceptable enough for inclusion in a car? So the automaker doesn't have to spend what they claim to be billions of dollars developing electronics for their cars, which is absolute rubbish. By the way, this is another thing I got to get off my chest. Someone tweeted that during CES that Audi announced that 30% of their cost structure of a car, or the cost, I should say it differently, 30% of the cost of a car is electronics today. And therefore, you know, they're all getting wise about making great technology for cars. I say, what nonsense. That's rubbish. It's not costing 30%. What the components that are in the car cost pennies, as little as they cost for a smartphone. The point is that these components are wedged into a process which is extremely costly. These components have to be engineered, and the product has to be developed, and the delays involved, and the people involved, and all of that causes...
So allocating all that overhead to the...
Yeah, exactly. So
exactly.
There's no way that when you tear down a car and you say, oh, it's got 15 sensors and 3-5 CPUs and the display is 2004 vintage, the CPU is 2006 vintage, you know. These things are not just commodities, but they're actually obsolete commodities. That's what's in your car, and they're claiming that that's costing the equivalent of $20,000. It's nonsense. They're capitalizing in a process and suggesting that that's the cost. I mean, arguably, and I've argued this before, the manufacturing process itself, the auto plant, is probably 40 to 50% of the cost of the car. So if you take away that bit and you say, well, yeah, that means engineering and design is another 10 to 20%, and manufacturing is 40%, and then the actual bill of materials in terms of steel and components is only 10 to 20% of a car. In this case, no one does that, but that's one way of doing it, right? Because the physical plant used to manufacture a car is not going to be cheaper than $1 billion. But no one says that of a computer, even though Intel does spend tens of billions of dollars making the fabs that make the chip, right? And so we don't say that a PC is a way to capitalize,
$5 billion.
Yeah. So I got that off my chest. But the point I want to make about the technology is that we have the means now to capture that information, and then, you know, an intelligent software algorithm could go through it and then give a score to the car that might be useful. Now, how that can be made into a business, I don't know. How that might affect the auto industry, I don't know. But it's an interesting thought. And it all came from this thought, this process
shopping
for a used car. I just concluded to myself, you know, we use proxies instead. We don't have that information, so we use proxies. We will pay a dealer more money because we trust somehow that the dealer has gone over the car, and they wouldn't have bought a car that they couldn't sell. So they probably know more about car buying than we do, and therefore we trust them as our buying agents. And so that's why car dealers make a premium in the first place. A used car dealer, I mean, there's no service component to a used car, right? It's not like a new car where you have the warranty period where you go back to the dealer and the dealer makes a huge profit on that sale, mostly through service. But used cars are different. And yet, a used car sold at a dealer has a $2,000 premium than the same used car sold by an individual. And there was also this question in my mind, why do we pay the dealer this? Why would anybody do that?
I have a social, maybe an anthropological aspect to this. We were in Mexico recently and then came back, and it was quite cold in the Midwest, talking with some friends, and one of the friends mentioned that three cars all didn't start at various times because, of course, they had to maintain the batteries. And we've always tried to teach our kids to check the tire pressure in the cars and the oil and all that. And you know, traveling around, it occurs to me that I think the auto maintenance skills of most people is not what it was 20 years ago. And I'm not talking about a lot of maintenance. I'm just talking about checking oil or fluids or tire pressure. And I think what you're reflecting there in evaluations illustrates this change. I think that, and we've talked about this before in previous shows, the interest people have in autos or transportation as a service as opposed to wanting to deal with, you know, dead batteries and, you know, flat tires. Maybe one of our neighbors' daughters, you know, ran the car without oil, and of course there goes the engine. You know, so there, it's interesting, and I think that what you're seeing in these valuations reflects also people's interest in just not dealing with it. They just want something that works, so they spend the money on the car.
Yeah, no, it's true, and I think that many people, if they are less inclined, if there's no one in their family who is willing to go under the hood and check things.
Right.
There's obviously, and this happened with computers as well. I mean, in the old days, you had to be knowledgeable about how to put, you know, how many people were like opening their computer cases, upgrading components, and you knew someone.
Absolutely.
Yeah, you knew someone who knew how to you know, install Windows and stuff like that. And that just doesn't even happen. People don't even install Windows. Today, if you want a new operating system, you buy a new computer.
Right.
And it's like, I sometimes joke about it, you know, we'll get to the point where if your car is dirty, you say, well, you know, I can't be bothered. I'll just buy a new car.
Right.
You,
right.
It's like it becomes a disposable item. That's both good and bad in a way. But I remember Volvo had this thing where they actually promoted women to a certain, because it's Sweden, you know, bless them. They promoted women to the positions of decision making in the car design and car engineering, or I suppose the car product development, and they came up with a concept car where essentially the hood would not open, and it wasn't user serviceable in that sense. So that what they did, they took a normal car and they simply essentially configured it so that the you know, you'd have to remove body panels to get to the engine, firstly, and secondly, they said the only things that you need to worry about as a user are where's the gas cap, number one, which is maybe a challenge for some. It used to be that, you know, you had to have a service attendant to fill up your car.
Right.
And number two, and number two, that, you know, things like refillable fluids, like, you know, the windshield washer. So show me where the spout for the windshield washer or the nozzle goes, and then I'm all set. And from that point of view, that makes actually a lot of sense for a lot of people. I don't dismiss it at all. I think that's perhaps where cars should go. And the Japanese famously also, I remember that there was a Toyota Previa as a van. It had its engine under the floor of the car, and it was really quite a hassle to find, you know, to check the oil and things like that. And when Toyota was asked about it, they said, well, you don't need to do that in our cars. In other words, our cars are so reliable that it isn't something we expect users to do. I think there would have been a pushback from some people who are still, the predominant buyers were males, would have said, you know, we don't like that. But as we move forward, I think that makes more sense. That's an observation. I think this it would be interesting for folks to read this, at least the Wikipedia article in the Market for Lemons, to sort of understand it. And we encourage to think about what happens when the information asymmetry diminishes, when there is less, when there's more transparency and less hiding of what happens in a car. That's really beautiful, because as folks who grew up in the technology world, we see how empowering it is to have access to information. And now we're at that point belatedly with automobiles.
So what might cause the dam to burst? You know, it's interesting to me that this last week. You have large tech companies not participating in this CES thing, which used to be, you know, somewhat of a big deal. I'm not sure how to describe it today, but you have the auto industry pretty active there. And Ford's top marketing guy mentioned this week, and now is pulling back, that they know when all their drivers speak,
right?
So that the data is being collected. And then we had Google's announcement with Audi and a few others who pushed some form of their OS in the cars, and maybe that would be the information actually for Google's purposes. Whether that goes anywhere else, I have my doubts. But I would think if they're following their normal pattern, that they're mining all of that data. So what will make the dam burst?
Who knows? We're kind of at this chicken and egg stage where I think one of the answers is that the auto industry is so insular, it's so integrated, and is so unwilling so rigid and unwilling to change, and that's structural. It's not just people, and their vices. I think it's really more about the fact that it's all, as we talked about, the spine, the backbone of the industry's production process, and the production process forces a lot of odd behavior in decision making. And I think one thing that will crack the nut is that if that production system changes, as we've advocated, then it would allow not just entrants to come. I think just the notion of an entrant coming in, fresh blood, would allow rethinking to happen. They're going to know, even Tesla, although they're using the same production system, foolishly in my opinion, but as Tesla, maybe they're flexible enough that at some point they're going to discard the production system. It's only a stopgap. I would love that. I'm not blaming them individually, but I'm just saying, they have to do what they have to do. But in the case of even the case of Tesla, the decision making about technology in use in the car, I mean, they're using touch screens, they're using certain, let's say, a bit newer ideas than what's out there. User interfaces are going to need to be updated and so on. But the real watershed event would be if a complete startup were to come in. And that reminds me, we have this production system, iStream, that's being put forward by Gordon Murray. Gordon's has just launched a website. We should put that in the show notes. iStream process, which is nothing new in terms of information. It's beautifully presented, much, much richer in its visuals than it used to be in the previous website, which was on the Gordon Murray Design website. So now iStream has its own presence. And what's exciting about it is also that they had their first license taker for the process, which is Yamaha. And the great thing
Maverick. Yamaha's always.
Oh, as a company, yeah, definitely. Absolutely. And so, first of all, if people don't know, Yamaha makes obviously motorcycles that people know, but they also make snowmobiles. They make the quad bikes or whatever they're called. They also make, I believe, jet skis.
Right.
That's in the motor space because they have great competency in small engines with high specific power, meaning power to weight ratios. They also actually co-engineered the engine that went into the Lexus or Toyota LFA, which is the hypercar that Toyota put out as its sort of its
statement.
Yeah, it's iconic, kind of like this is the best we can do. And that engine, which is actually, I believe, six cylinders, is engineered by, and I may even be partly produced by Yamaha. And it's basically a scaled-up motorcycle engine, right? Because it revs at very, very high speed, very high RPM, and it does so instantly. And so that gives it an enormous, almost Formula One-like performance. And so that's where Yamaha comes from. Plus, by the way, they're in the music business, right? They make instruments.
Sure, sure.
So they have a very eclectic kind of technological base, and yet they've never made a car. And so that makes perfect sense that they would go to a new process and say, you know, instead of spending $1 billion to get into the car business, which is crowded anyway, why don't we actually scale up our motorcycles into cars? And so we make these microcars using a new process, which is a combination of tubular construction, exoskeleton with composite panels, and that type of vehicle as well. It's all explained in the website. You can go check it out. And there's wonderful visuals on this new concept. Now, they took a license. It's not clear whether they're going to go into production. The decision has not been made, though the prototype has been shown at car shows or as at events. And that's consistent with the hypothesis that a new process for manufacturing is going to be embraced much more readily by entrants. In this case, a sort of a hybrid entrant, which is in the motor and mobility, but not quite in the automobile. So it's a great story for the process. It's a great story for the theory as well. And let's see what troubles me, though, is how long it's taken, even though this is a great idea, even though it should attract entrants. And Gordon Murray has stated in his in some interviews that there are takers. There have been discussions with a lot of players, and he suggests that even Apple could make a car, even Walmart could make a car. So I think he's spoken to these types of players, but no deal has been struck yet. And the first deal is actually the anchor deal is done with this, again, hybrid entrant. But what's interesting is that we're not seeing the incumbents jumping up and down on this idea, over this idea. They're saying, you know, I would have loved to see, for example, Mercedes come with its smart brand and saying, you know, the next smart brand, which, by the way, already uses composite panels, already is a microcar, already has, there's a strong demand for that car to be done differently because it could benefit from lightweight, it could benefit from limited production runs. By the way, the other thing to note as we talked last time with, remembered Richard Marks, he mentioned that tubular process in general is good for 50,000 up to 50,000 units.
Right.
And Gordon Murray claims in his latest website that it's actually good for 100,000. His process, which is somewhat more advanced, meaning I believe that he's using some kind of robotic welding and that the tubes are a little bit, it's a slightly more advanced version. There might be some parts that are manufactured in a different way than manually, right? Which is how you think about people welding tubes together, which is the way race cars are built. So if you can automate that to some degree, I think the economies of scale get up to 100,000 units. 100,000 units is a decent production environment. It's certainly bigger than the Tata Nano. It's probably about a half of what the Mini was actually originally slated to do in Oxford. I think they're up to 300,000, but when they ramped up, it took a decade to get there. So I think they probably didn't get over 100,000 in the first years. So it's certainly good enough to put out a product like the Nano or a product like the Mini, at least during the first years. And even so, you can see how in one plant you can do this and then maybe build a second plant to do it in another location. And although the economies may not be as good, two 100,000 unit plants is one 300,000 unit plant. This, it still may make sense once you factor in some of the other costs of shipping and distribution and labor and everything else. So it may, you know, I don't have any proof of course, but I think that there's something to this. And so my it's very exciting to see progress on this. But as I said, The thing I'm down on, the thing I'm not happy about is how long it's taken. It's taken Murray's team, I think, years. I think they began discussions with Yamaha in 2007 or 8, and they admitted that. And then they said the plans were put on hold due to the credit crunch recession. And so automobiles were just a dead business in 2008 and 2009. And they only came back to it in 2010. And here we are in 2014.
Still a frontal product. Just an announcement.
And even so, they're saying, well, if we forget the green light, customers are going to be able to buy these in 2016. So you're talking about, you know, an 8-year process from concept. Okay, it's the first time. It's the first sale. It's the anchor deal. Yes, it's going to take longer. But and maybe in after a few more of these, we're going to be down to a 4 or 5 year cycle. It's still a very long cycle compared to consumer electronics, where things are changing on a nearly monthly basis. And that's still an artifact of the industry. The other thing, by the way, that this could enable is contract manufacturing, because brands could be separated from production. And this is, again, what's happened in many, many other industries, from apparel to computing to smartphones. You can have a brand positioned for a market in, let's say, a country like India, and production happens either locally or remotely, but it's done in an aggregated fashion, so that there'll be contract manufacturers who say, okay, send us your blueprints, we're going to get your car, you know, in certain number of units in a certain time frame. That does not exist. This concept of contract manufacturing exists in almost every industry except the automobile industry. There are one or two contract manufacturers. Before anybody jumps down my throat, I know there's one even in Finland. There are some in Germany, and there are some in Asia.
It's a
tiny niche. And the volumes they're producing are in the tens of thousands versus the tens of millions that the integrated players are doing.
In terms of our earlier topic of information asymmetry, do you have to be a Gordon Murray or Richard Marx wandering in the wilderness for 10 years to implement these changes? What does that mean for this outlook of transformation to the auto industry? And then if you think about other manufacturers, you know, BMW has their i3, which is a tubular composite design. But I think your earlier point about Intel and their fabs is true, in that these traditional players have these billion-dollar factories, and that is all they think about. And in fact, Richard Marx alluded to that in our earlier discussion, where he said, you know, as a supplier, they would say, just build this thing. Don't tell me about improving it. Don't, you know, just hear the specs, build it.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, this is the trillion-dollar question. How do you change from what appears to be, you know, an interlocked global conspiracy almost of production technique? My point is, and the history would suggest that change will not come from within. Change will not come from within the industry, even if the greatest ideas served to them in a silver platter. They are too dependent upon, and I don't mean this, again, I always say that you have to walk a mile in their shoes. They have to deal with the situation, right? They're just besieged by problems. And solving these problems, they don't have any capacity to say, or freedom to say, you know, screw it, we'll do it a different way. They can't do that, right? There's a famous line, I use this in a SimConf, about freedom, and it comes from a Janis Joplin song. Freedom is another word for having nothing to lose. And that is not the case. These automakers have tons to lose. They have billions to lose. So they don't have freedom. Who has the freedom is the entrant. They have nothing to lose, right? So that's the challenge until now has been for an entrant to come into the industry, they need a few billion dollars. And yes, there have been some which have obtained that, and namely the Korean and Japanese entrants, or I should say Chinese. Japanese is many decades ago, but they too were entrants. But more recently, the Korean and what's called the Pacific Rim markets, so Malaysia, Korea, perhaps even Indonesia, and certainly China, have gotten into the car business. And they've done it through obtaining billions of dollars of funding. How did they obtain it? Well, the government, of course. The governments have granted them, either through loans or through other means, access to capital. And it's not a business plan that gets funded these days because you go to a VC and you say, hey, I have a great idea. Let's do a new car business. Tesla aside from, but Tesla gets huge amount of government funding as well through loans and other things, yeah, right?
Tax credits, sure.
Energy tax credits and so on. So there's no way that the government isn't involved. But in the case of China and other places, it is grossly involved. It is obviously involved. And when we look at the political game played, it's like the entrants are, you know, maybe they were making trucks and buses and they said, hey, can we have permission to become car makers? And then they leveraged this and that to become a car maker. And there's a whole hierarchy of the needs of the individual. When you look, you can analyze it from the, you know, what is going through the minds of the executives in China, and there's a whole weird game there. But the point is that there have been entrants, and they've done it through brute force. They simply said, give us a few billion of dollars. We're going to build a few car plants. It's going to be a good thing for the country, for the economy, for the nation. And they've done that in several nations in the Pacific Rim. And maybe now there are people who are trying to emulate them. By the way, another example is in Europe, a big car manufacturing, quote, startup has been in the Slovakia, actually, in the former Czechoslovakia, the Slovak half of Czechoslovakia has actually risen to a preeminent position in manufacturing. But in that case, what we're looking at is sister plants being set up by the incumbents in Europe. So you have Volkswagen, you have Volkswagen Group, which is enormous. You also have joint ventures by Citroën, like the Aygo, which is a very popular micro car in Europe. The Aygo is actually co-built by Toyota, Citroën, and I think Peugeot as a joint ventured into this Slovakian plant to make these micro cars that are branded under three different brands. But the point is that this is all really a rehash of the existing process and the existing methodology. It's just that they said, the entrants said, we want to join your club. They didn't say, we want to redo redefine what a club is. We want to redefine what a car company is.
Oh, they just want to go to the party.
Yeah, they just said, well, we deserve to be a car manufacturing economy because we understand that one in five jobs in the manufacturing are in the automotive industry, and this is simply part of our growing up process. We just got to join these ranks. Just like going, you know, like the Chinese are building rockets to send them to the, you know, go to the moon and places like that. It's part of a rite of passage in a way. You've got to be in the car business. It doesn't matter if it makes money. It doesn't matter if it makes sense. Matter if you have any competitive advantage, just do it. You know, we have to. It's a matter of almost of honor. So I'm not judging it. It's just that's the way it is. The point I'm making though is that for the process to change, for innovation to happen, there has to be an entrant that's motivated by making a killing, right? Motivating them by money, but not by politics, not by nationalism, not by ego. It's motivated simply because they say, you know, I think we can do it better. Yeah. And again, Tesla is the only example, although again, there's a lot of baggage that goes with that. What I'm looking forward to with this iStream process is, or others like it, what Richard Marx was saying about that, you know, he's an entrant in that sense. And so it's great to see that, and it's made possible by modularity. It's made possible by commoditization of components, including the electronics. It's made possible by new processes. And that's where I want to see, and always the people, first objection when I just tweeted this quote from Dr. Murray, who's basically saying that anybody can now make a car. And immediately the response is, yeah, but what about the regulation? What about what about litigation? What about all these problems the industry has? Well, the real entrepreneurs figures a way around that.
Well, sure. Mark said, low-speed vehicle, low-speed urban vehicles.
Yes, you gain a foothold. Yeah. You don't crack the tough nut first. No. You go for the easy stuff, and you find niches, non-consuming niches. You know, this is why I advocate that the best home for iDream is not just an entrant, but an entrant building a car in a country which doesn't have any other manufacturing, perhaps. This would be actually a wonderful idea to take to a country that wants to industrialize, the country that is not consuming, quote unquote, the process of manufacturing. And so the whole discussion, and I've said this in other ways also on Twitter, the whole discussion is not about here at ASIM Car. We don't talk about the product, the car. We talk about the process of car making, including design, including product development, but also including manufacturing. It's what's broken about cars isn't the product. The product is great, and it's getting better in probably more ways than it needs to be. In fact, it's probably better than great.
I think you see a general trend up market amongst all of them, and that's maybe the seeds are already being sown for the new thing to
But the point is that what's not good enough is the process. And you might say, well, what are you talking about? Again, it's billions of dollars in investment and all that. But the process actually is over-serving as well. And there's been no disruption of the process. In what happens is in the industry, in terms of disruption we've gone through, and this is, okay, we go back and some of the greatest stories of disruption come from the auto industry. It's how Japan disrupted the United States by first building really cheap, crummy little cars. And what happened then is, the rusty Toyotas of the 70s became Lexuses of the 90s. And now because Toyotas have gotten so posh and
fashionable in some ways, yeah,
and luxurious and everything else, they've actually had to introduce sub-brands like Scion, mm-hmm, to just put low end again. Toyota has gotten too good in that sense. So what the industry does is they introduce new brands. So same thing with BMW. They got too good, so they introduced Mini. Same thing with Mercedes. They got too good, and then they introduced Smart, or they bought Smart. In both cases, they bought brands that fit the low-end image, right? So then, what you see how Toyota went, first of all, they said, Toyota is too cheap. We need to actually accelerate our move into upmarket. So they introduced Lexus, right? Mm-hmm. Not in all the world, but in the Lexus brand became the high end, which allowed them to quickly run up the trajectory more rapidly in terms of people's perceptions and trust, not just executing on luxury, but actually getting people to believe that it is luxurious. That's why they had to introduce a new brand. And then they got so far ahead of themselves, they had to go to brands below Toyota to be able to just stay in the low end. And so this game of brand or badge management is part of the process of sort of also preventing preventing disruption to happen. But all of that is about the product. None of that has anything to do with the process. None of that. You don't see Toyota launching, okay, we need a cheap car, a low-end car. Let's also throw away all our car manufacturing, which, by the way, is the Toyota system, which is held up as the sort of the gold standard, right? And we're going to go through to the exact opposite, hand-built cars almost, have them done in a garage type of
operation. Shop environment. So the interesting thing when looking at this, and we've talked about the emerging information layer both in this show and previous ones, but the sustaining efforts at the current model are obviously enormous. And I was astonished recently to see a new car dealership flattened not far from my office, and a used car dealer going up, a big one called CarMax. So I looked at their annual reports. I sent you a link the other day. And I found a quote in there that, you know, they always talk about risk. So CarMax's model is essentially a retail used car spot. So they're playing on that gap between used car value or cost and what they think they can sell it for. But they mentioned as a risk factor that, increasing online availability of used vehicle information, including pricing, could make it more difficult for us to differentiate our service. So maybe the next evolution of this would be to take good used cars and create car sharing services and drive costs down that way.
I got to check it out. So CarMax, you say?
It's a public company, yeah. But it's all CarMax. It's a used car retail play, and they're expanding, which sort of surprises me, I guess. Given what we discussed earlier. So I guess my point is, if you think about all the things to sustain this, you know, CarMax being one, obviously it's on Wall Street, it's a public company. You've got the insurance companies, you've got the dealer networks, you've got the finance model, you know, on and on and on, that are just keeping it going. And I think you've mentioned in other shows, you know, the cable TV business, right, where if they drop their subscribers in half, they'll double the cost, and, you know, they're high. And this smells like that to me, where you've got so much interest in the current model that a new entrant would really have to come at it a very different way. And maybe it is the low-speed urban cars.
Yeah, so or the emerging market or not even emerging. I'm thinking Africa. I'm thinking Central Asia. I'm thinking, you know, the last parts of the earth that are not yet paved. And those the problem might be that you want to gain a foothold there, and then that will be used over time to convince others to sort of do the right thing in the more consuming areas. This is the same phenomenon, by the way, with, for example, solar power. When you try to put solar power and put it head to head against the grid, it always loses. I mean, even if it's cheap, there's just too many hassles, too much unreliability. This is why solar and other alternative energy sources tend to fail because they're trying to be marketed against a very sufficient and reliable alternative. The problem is in areas where there's insufficient energy, these not good enough in terms of reliability and so on, are going to be acceptable. And so this is classic competition against non-consumption. But again, the point I'm making is not non-consumption of vehicles. It's non-consumption of manufacturing processes. You have to ask yourself, who buys manufacturing processes? Who needs them? Who funds them? To what purpose are they used? And then you ask yourself, well, I have on my table three manufacturing processes, one which is an integrated billion-dollar plant, another which is this, you know, modular version, and perhaps another alternative, something hybrid. And then the decision-making that goes into that at this point is done by governments, typically, right? Do I want to? I'm a non-consumer of manufacturing. I want to get into manufacturing. So what manufacturing process do I have? Well, until now, the only object sitting on that table was the integrated car plant. So they said, yeah, I definitely need this. That's all that's available. I'll take two. So that's how Korea came on and so on. The thing I'm saying is now for these other countries that haven't yet joined the club, they suddenly have more than one option. They have this other alternative, and I'm suggesting that actually that may be a more attractive option because then they don't have to figure out a way to finance it as much. So anyway, long story. I'm just telling it over and over.
Sure. So I just want to close with one possible angle, and I'm kind of curious how it's going. I have not tried it yet, but I know this company Automatic has created an app. An iPhone.
Yeah, I know about that. So it's
back into your car's data system, collect data. So that may be, if it gets legs, an asymmetric information angle, because essentially you're pulling it all out.
So yeah,
using
so
your
what
smartphone.
This is a great example. Yeah. So Automatic, which I'm dying to try myself.
Yes.
It goes into the ODB3, I think,
right,
port in your car, and essentially it's a hack. It's a hack because it should be there already. Right, these guys hijacked,
yes,
if you will,
until the automakers turn it off. Yeah,
Not in any illegal or unethical way, but it is a hack because they said, oh, we can use this port that's meant for mechanics or service people to look at. We can plug in something in there and then take that information to your phone via Bluetooth. And so you have an onboard display and storage medium that lets you get that information about your car that normally is not meant for you. And then we provide it a beautiful interface. This is exactly what I'm talking about. But what I'm saying is if it was a bit more integrated in a way that, it needs to be slightly easier to use. You don't want to have people, again, going under their car's hood and figuring out how to do this. Right, it's got this
snow,
this
yeah.
Yeah, it's got this sort of like hacker
right.
thing feel
yeah,
to
absolutely.
It, right? And but you see the potential right there, right? The information is there. It's not currently stored because if you told the car manufacturer, oh, why don't you just put some flash memory in your car and then put that port, make it so that the
Low
car itself,
right? It's all there.
Yeah, they'll say, oh, sure, that great idea. Yeah, what 1 gigabyte of flash in there? Okay, $10,000.
Right.
That's that. What's that option's going to cost you? And so, this instead you get a $30 whatever dongle.
It's $100 per car is what they're charging, yeah.
How much, $100?
$199.95.
Yeah, I bet they're making huge margin on it, too. So that's such a natural idea. But, okay, the car industry looks at that and it either shrugs its shoulders or says, yeah, well, we'll do it, but we'll, give us 5 years and we're going to end up pricing it at $10,000
right.
as an option. So... That's what we're facing, and in some ways, you know, whenever you try to ask the story I learned in business school, there's only one good story I can say here. Maybe is to ask five times the why question. Why is it this way? And most people say, the answer is, we just need standards. Well, why aren't there standards? Okay, why have 100 manufacturers not even bothered to think about this? There's something fundamentally broken if the obvious solution that anybody can think up in 5 minutes isn't implemented. It is. There's something else deeper. So then, when you start to understand the industry as a whole, you realize that it is this interconnectedness of decision making, and this is the guardian knot, the thing you cannot cut through. And so the way you solve the puzzle is you step out of it. You say, okay, this is the right thing to do. Now, why can't we just start with a clean sheet of paper, a green field, and do the right thing? And then you realize, because we need a few billion dollars. And then this is where salvation comes in the form of a new process. And you say, okay, well, you can finally execute on this plan of bringing an intelligent vehicle to reality that is modular and something upgradable by the at the cycle time of technology, not of sheet metal bending. So that's the pitch.
Sounds like we're seeing the seeds of possible disruption or possible change with iStream and maybe, this automatic approach where you're hacking your own car and maybe future versions of that. And then we have changes with entrants coming into the auto game, Google doing deals with car manufacturers to extract data, obviously, and Microsoft and Apple, perhaps. So the seeds are there, but maybe it'll take a few more years.
Yes, it may still take another year, which gives us plenty of time to talk about it.